Good morning, good morning, good morning, and thank you for joining me on another episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. I, of course, am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I have an amazing show for you today. We have a very diverse group today, but very interesting. We were chatting backstage, and I can't wait to introduce you to everyone that is here with us this morning. But before I do that, I'm going to ask you to do what I always ask you to do, and that is to go ahead and share this show. But don't just share it. Come on now, be an evangelist for the Roundtable Talk Show. I want you to find the person in your house who is sleeping the most peacefully, and I want you to wake them up. I want you to let them know the Roundtable Talk Show is on. So share this, text it, tweet it, put the message out, because friends don't let friends miss out on the Roundtable Talk Show. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first guest. And she interests me for a lot of different reasons. And one of the main reasons is I'm in the process of launching my very first Powered by Purpose two-day teleconference. And the focus is empowerment. It's an empowerment experience. And there are so many people in the world right now who are lending a hand to help the world become a better place by empowering others. So I want to go ahead and introduce Ms. Nadine Russell of Entice the Brow. Did I say that correctly?
Entice the Brand.
The Brand. See, when I take notes fast, I confuse myself. I apologize. Let me give you a better introduction. Entice the Brand. Nadine Russell, Women's Empowerment Mentor. Good morning, Nadine. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing really well. I'm really excited to be on the show this morning and just connect with other really great entrepreneurs. I'm excited. I've seen some of the episodes before and I'm like, I love what you're doing. And congratulations on launching your first empowerment conference. That's huge. I love that.
Thank you. So which episodes did you see? I want to see which episodes were you watching?
I don't remember the exact date before I sent out the message to you about my interest in being on the show. There was one that you guys were doing and you were talking about some of the things that was happening. There was a lady on there that was like an organizational cleaner. Like she
cleans stuff.
I was
Allison Allman is on the show every Monday. And every Monday she has something else to talk about. She is so amazing. She's going to be at the conference as well.
Oh, nice. I love that because for me, like cleaning and like organizing, it's been like a touch and go. Like I'll either be like really into it or over it. So seeing that episode and the information that she brought was really interesting. And just seeing everybody on there and having a good time. I had watched like a few, I guess it was about a month ago now, that last episode. And yeah, I was like, I definitely want to connect and be a part of the conversation. And I was a little bit nervous, to be honest, coming on because I'm like, oh, I'm in Canada. And I wasn't sure if you had a lot of international guests on, because from what I saw, most of the guests were American. And I was like, oh, this should be a good experience and just getting to connect with more people.
No, it's interesting what shows you watch. And that's why I love doing this show. I launched on March 30th. I had no idea. This is one of my brilliant ideas I came up with at 3 a.m. that probably should have been vetted by someone. I don't know who. But I was like, how do you put all these people together? And they're all so different, but it's just amazing how we come together to help each other. And that has been the most beautiful aspect. Now, what made you decide to become an empowerment mentor?
A lot of it really came from a place of where I had been in my life, knowing how difficult it was for me to really find my way and not feeling support. The major player in my life that has supported me all along has been my mother, but then there's been a lot of friends and family members that may not have been as supportive, and just growing up and always feeling left out, being the only Black child in my school, in my class for a lot of times, and just knowing that I was different and being super tall and super strange and a little bit awkward, and a lot of people maybe not understanding me as a person and feeling really isolated and really by myself, I really dimmed my light. I really didn't have the confidence to do a lot of the things that I really wanted to do because of the judgment. I was so used to getting judged by others. I was so used to people not really believing in me, and just having my mother believing in me at all times really helped me to see that what I want in life is possible and I can make my dreams possible. And I felt like really isolated and alone. And as I went through life, I noticed that I was not the only person that was going through that. And I'm like, you know what? I know what it feels like to be in this position, and I want to be able to help other women in that position to realize that they are important, their gifts matter, their voice matters, and help them to get over those limiting beliefs and those negative thought patterns and those people in their life that really made them feel like they weren't good enough, and help them to see that they are good enough and love themselves again and start doing the things that really make them happy.
That was so wonderful. That was beautiful. Like, I'm sending you a virtual hug from here. Like, I'm just like, I'm sending it to you because I've been there. I've had that feeling. I talk about when I built my first website. It was 1994. And you know what people told me? They told me I was lazy. They said that because I wanted to be at home with my daughter, they didn't include the daughter part, but I wanted to be at home with my daughter, but I wasn't going out to get a job, then I was lazy. But it was 1994. I was ahead of my time, and I didn't understand then how far ahead of my time I was. So now, when I work with people as a business consultant, one of the things that I express to them is simply that I'm here to believe in your dream. If no one else in the world, believes, because sometimes it's our family, the people who love us the most, who give us the hardest time because they want us to go get that safe job. They want, in their mind, they want the best for us. They want us to go the tried and true route, tried and true route. And entrepreneurs, we know that's not our way.
Yeah, that's so true. And the thing is growing up, I always knew that I didn't like working for people. I didn't like people telling me what to do. I was just one of those kids. I go to school and I love to help people. Like from I was younger, and I used to get in trouble. So I'd be done my work earlier than everybody else in my class. I go and try to help other people, and the teachers would get upset, tell me to sit down. And my mom's like, give her extra work. But they never
My
wanted to give me extra work.
mom did
They never
the same
did.
thing. That's what I said. My mom did the same thing. I tell people I'm 44, but if they had had ADHD when I was a kid, I'd have been diagnosed with it. I was running all over, talking to everybody till my mom cured me. She was like, give her some more work.
Well, and that's the thing. My mom is like, well, if she's doing her work before everyone else and she's completing it, obviously she needs more work to do. So challenge her, give her more work. And they refused to give me more work. So I was just like, okay, whatever. This is me just helping people. I'm gonna get in trouble for helping people. It was really strange. And my mom is the type of person, she likes that security, she likes working. And my dad is very entrepreneurial. So I wasn't raised with my dad. So I didn't really understand what was happening. And as I got older, I actually had a recent conversation with him and found out that not only is he an entrepreneur, my grandparents were entrepreneurs, my great grandparents were entrepreneurs. So I'm like, so this is in my blood. Like I have to be an entrepreneur. All my siblings are entrepreneurs. So I'm just really trying to step into my calling and just trust the journey because it's not easy at all, at all, at all. Every entrepreneur that I talk to, they say the same thing over and over again. You get ridiculed, you get judged. I remember the first thing I started was a blog. I was blogging and making YouTube videos back in the day, like early 2000. And people thought I was crazy. They're like, what are you doing? That's so weird. Now, half of those people are having blogs, they're vlogging, they're starting their own businesses. And it's like when you're before your time, you don't think that you know what you're doing because everybody's looking at you like something's wrong with you. So then you conform and you're like, okay, fine, I'll go and get the job because this is super weird and I don't know how I'm gonna make a living off of this. So you just do what everyone tells you to do. And then you realize how uncomfortable you are in doing that. And you're like, no, there has to be another way.
Yes, and that's entrepreneurship because I'm looking at you. I'm like, you must be my twin in a different life because I'm the same way. My dad's entire line, that bloodline, entrepreneurs. My dad has had his own business in California since 1985. Now my mom, she's corporate, high up. She's been at jobs 20 plus years. She's been at this last one 15 or so years. Corporate executive. And it's like I don't know which, but I wind up now going more into that entrepreneurship. But what I want to do in the plan for, and what I invite other entrepreneurs should do is don't just focus on the entrepreneurship, build the businesses. You know, small businesses are the heart of America. So don't, well, of the world, you know, you're in Canada. Which reminds me, if you watch yesterday's show, one lady was in London and one guy was in Ho Chi Minh City. So yes, international show. But I want to come back to you, Nadine. We were talking about learning and the different way kids learn. And like I said, I was the kid that ran all around because my mind was always going. So I want to introduce our next guest, Ms. Laura Hart, who actually runs online STEM classes for kids, Robo Fun. Good morning, Laura. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning, Sharifa. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, would you say that children learn in different ways?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say that what we need to do in the 21st century is address that we all learn differently and that we need to set up learning environments for kids that allow for different kinds of learners. And we need, you know, kids know a lot more than we give them credit for knowing. And it's possible to say to kids, you know, here's the topic that we're going to study. What ways should we go about it? What would be interesting for you? You know, we're going to study, for instance, the American Revolution, but we're going to also study how it was presented in history, not necessarily correctly, as we understand more and more. Do you want to watch videos? Do you want to read old newspapers? Do you want to interview people? And kids know what they want. We all know they know what they want, but you know, at the end of the project, when it's their turn to present, that's a real opportunity to say to the kids, how do you want to present what you've learned so far? Do you want to write a paper? Do you want to write a newspaper with other kids in the class? Do you want to make a video about it? Do you want to do live interviews? So we often make assumptions that kids don't know about what's important to them and how to go about things, and they frequently do if it hasn't been drilled out of them.
Absolutely. Now, for those who are watching who are unfamiliar with STEM, what is the STEM, I guess, process?
Sure. So STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and it's an acronym. And the newest acronym in this field is STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics. And what I'm not a fan of acronyms. It's a little bit like we don't study Shakespeare through an acronym, and the five fields of STEM, there's a lot of things in there. But the one, you know, there's good things about it as well, which is it pushes people to understand the importance of it. It also adding art helps people understand that creativity is a huge part of STEM, and that it's not an either or. It's not like you study painting or you study coding. I'm kind of an example of that because I'm also a painter. But life, you know, studying passions and having different passions makes us all richer people. And the same for kids. I think it's really important for kids not to focus too early, but to study and to learn and to dive into many different fields.
Yes, and to be well-rounded. I was so disappointed at how
Right.
much music and art was taken, and not even just music and art, but home economics and classes that teach children about more than just the basics. So tell us a little bit about RoboFun, please.
Sure. So RoboFun is 22 years old, and we offer children a creative place to learn about STEM and STEAM. And in 5 months, we have taken everything we've done. Up until 5 months ago, we were running about 130 classes a week in New York City public, private, and charter schools. And in our center on 102nd Street and Broadway in Manhattan. And then COVID hit, and as with many private small companies, I was like, well, how am I going to manage this one? Being a single mom and having managed many events, my child had five major surgeries in his childhood. I'm kind of used to surviving. So I said to my staff, okay, we're going online. We're going to figure it out and we're going to go online. And one of the things I had learned along the way is that small class size is really important. So we took 2 weeks and we experimented with a bunch of free classes. We tried a couple kids, we tried eight kids. We came to that the number we're comfortable with is only five children at a time.
Okay.
And so we've been running classes since about March 30th with up to five kids. And we're running them this fall. In fact, this week we start a cycle. Well, the cycle starts this week, but it will allow people to enter for another week or two. And your child has, depending on their age, we run classes for kids 3 to 13. The little itty bitty cuties, there needs to be a parent very nearby or the child on your lap. You're learning a pre-coding environment made by my colleagues and friends at MIT called Scratch Junior, and that's a coding environment. If your kids are older, you don't need them, and they're not going to sit on your lap. They'll work independently, and our classes for them are about an hour and 20 minutes long once a week, and they'll learn coding, or they'll learn robotics. And the cool part of that is in our pivot, we figured out a fantastic robotic system that we ship to your house. So your child is actually building and learning with a robotics system called the Hummingbird from Bird Brain Robotics, Bird Brain Technologies. And so they'll either be doing coding, robotics, Minecraft and circuitry. Every child that I have found practically loves Minecraft. And so I'm a big believer in what do kids love and why don't we work with what they love? So from that, we created a whole circuitry component. So they're using the redstone, it's called the redstone mode of Minecraft to build things and to learn all about circuits, resistors, all different concepts in circuitry. And then the fourth, which is maybe my favorite, is animation. So if you have a child at home who might be a Wallace and Gromit lover, they can do animation at home with many of the tools we're using right here, the camera on your phone, the camera on your computer. So those are the four areas. And we're running classes. We ran about 250 different classes in those 5 months. And we're excited to move into the fall with more classes.
Well, I am impressed. I must say, I am impressed. That was amazing. Now, you said several times, you said coding. Right. I understand the word coding, but I just don't, so the children, what are they coding?
All right, well, I want to just start by saying the coding environment we use is called Scratch, and it was developed by my colleague, Dr. Mitchell Resnick at MIT, who I've known for about 30 years. And it used to be called programming, and everyone, and you know, I love programming. It's a very specific way to understand concepts, and you understand a little area and you add a little bit more code and something happens, but it was never called coding. And suddenly it's cool and it's called coding. So they are programming or coding. And I once mentioned that to Mitchell and he rolled his eyes like, yes, suddenly what we're doing is now cool, which is great.
So, okay, so again, what are the terms? So programming, coding. So yes. Are they programming computers, websites? What are they programming?
They are programming computers in a language right now called Scratch. And they are basically, if you think about putting Lego pieces together, they're visually doing that to make something happen. So if I come back, I can prepare and show a little example. But what kids like to make is games. And so what they're coding is a computer game, what we used to call a video game.
Oh, wow.
So even the little 3 and 4 year olds are coding simple little pieces, more like sentences or paragraphs of a game. And the older ones are doing full games where, you know, you have to travel across the screen and not get stuck in the lava. And if your character gets stuck in the lava, you lose a point. And that gets into some coding concepts of you have loops or things that happen over and over again. And if you lose a certain number of points, then you end up in the lava forever. That kind of thing.
I like it. That's interesting. It challenges the brain. I want to come back to you, Laura, but speaking of challenging the brain, I want to introduce our next guest, who is known as America's smartest comedian. He's going to talk to us about being a stand-up comedian, Mr. Sean Eli. Good morning, Sean. How are you?
I am good. How is everybody?
Excited to have you here.
Well, I don't have a prepared speech, so I'm ready to answer questions. I mean, you've got all these people who are so accomplished on the show here, and I stand on a box and talk into a stick. That's pretty much my job.
Yeah, okay. See, that's part of the whole shtick, is that you make people laugh. I found that funny. But America's Smartest Comedian, I know you have something to tell us.
Oh,
how
no.
How did you get America's Smartest Comedian then? How did you come to be called that?
Well, it was one of America's Smartest Comedians. It was actually in Reader's Digest, so I don't know how much credence you give it. But they
I've
were
heard
talking
of Reader's
about...
Digest.
Sorry?
I said, I've heard of Reader's Digest.
Okay. It's not exactly Harvard Business Review or the New England Journal of Medicine, but I guess it counts for something.
I read Reader's Digest, though. I haven't read any of the others, so hey.
Oh, no, New England Journal of Medicine is hilarious. It's the best comedy magazine there is. So I just decided when I started in comedy to talk about things that interested me and not sort of the dumb, you know, the dumb mindless jokes that people talk about. Now, I was doing a show in Philly a few years ago, and I was being with three other colleagues, and I was being interviewed by the Philadelphia Inquirer, and they said, what does smart comedy mean? I said, it's just sort of the absence of stupidity. It's not like we have jokes about Voltaire. And when it got published, one of the comics in the show called me up and she said, I have a Voltaire joke. So, I mean, I sometimes open with a joke about the Supreme Court, and sometimes people really appreciate the joke and sometimes they don't have the background to understand exactly. And I can tell you the joke, I guess, because if you tell somebody about a joke, you sort of have to tell them the joke.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, so I say, I had an interesting drive here. Well, you may remember a few years ago, the Supreme Court decided that corporations are the same as people legally. You remember this?
Yeah.
So on the drive here, I threw two stock certificates into my passenger seat, drove here in a carpool lane.
I like that. That was funny.
And 95% of the time, it does fine. And 5% of the time, as soon as I say Supreme Court, people's eyes just glaze over. And I'm like, okay, now I know where this is going to go.
Now, one of the things I've been told is that comedians are the truth speakers of the nation. So whatever is going on in the world, comedians are the ones who are going to give you at least their truth, as opposed to other people who might want to sugarcoat it or be politically correct. But that's why we tune into comedians.
Well, I would say that's true. And with the joke I just told, I think to me, it's really satire of a stupid Supreme Court decision. Corporations are not the same as people. They're two distinct, you know, entities, and they shouldn't be treated the same, whether it's for legal purposes or tax purposes or getting out of a ticket purposes. Mm-hmm. So I think using satire and irony to point stuff out is a comedian's job, but mainly we do it to make people laugh. You can go in there and point out all the stupidity in the world and irony, and if people aren't laughing, we're not doing our job.
Oh, I think that's nice. So basically, it's more of like the human interest aspect of it. Like, you really want to comedians lighten people's load. You can't walk out of a comedy show the same way you walked in. You feel better, you feel happier, you feel lighter, I would say.
Well, I did a show at a theater, a small theater, between when Trump was elected and when he took office. So I think it was late November of 2016. And one of the comedians, we do, my group, the Ivy League of Comedy, we do Q&A with the audience after the show, which audiences love because for them, it's like getting invited backstage. They can ask us questions. They feel like they're hanging out with us. And one of the comedians went off on Donald Trump. And I got a call from the executive director of the theater. And these are small theaters. They're nonprofit. They operate on a shoestring and they really need donors to stay in business. And she said, and she was not a Trump supporter, but she said, listen, I got a complaint from a donor. He didn't like the fact that it was political. And so when you guys come back in February, don't do any political material. And part of me felt like telling her, listen, you know, at the time, the Republicans wanted to get rid of the National Endowment for the Arts. And I said, if the NEA goes away, I'm going to come back in February and this is going to be a Dunkin' Donuts. But I just said, okay, fine. And And it was weird because I thought, you know, the winners shouldn't be complaining. People are talking about them. You think the losers would have of an election would have more to complain about. But we went back in February and I told the comics about it. We did no political material at all. And then when we did Q&A, the first question we got was, with all that's going on and all the changes in the country, how come none of you talked about it? Mm-hmm. And one of the comics was about to tell them, hey, we were told not to. And I gave her a look and she said, didn't you come here to get away from all of that? And I think that's the right answer, because sometimes you go to a comedy show not to hear about problems, but to just have fun and forget about your problems.
Yes. Great answer. I like that answer, Sean. All my family are comedians, or they love comedy, let's say. That's our joke. Like, everyone's a comedian in the family. We always have the best time. So I grew up with Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Martin Lawrence, watching all of them on television. I was watching an interview that Martin Lawrence did years ago about being a comedian. And one of the things that he said is the hardest aspect for him was telling the same joke over and over and over and over again. It's like, it's funny the first time, but when you have 100 shows on this tour to do, making it the 99th time, sometimes it's difficult. Do you find that to be true? And are there ways that you're able to make that happen?
I really haven't experienced that. I mean, there's some jokes I've been telling for 17 years. Mm-hmm. The best thing for me, my favorite thing to do in stand-up comedy, maybe my favorite thing in life, is thinking of a joke on the drive to a show and then trying it out right at the beginning. The standard advice to a comic is don't open with a new joke and don't close with a new joke, because you never know how it's going to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't close with a new joke, but sometimes I'll open with something because there's such energy. I'm not that energetic a comedian, but I have such energy when I have a new joke I'm just dying to try out that I really want to start with that joke. And that really helps. But I don't have a problem telling the same joke over and over again. I'm pretty happy with it. And there's some comics who are like, I've been doing this for 6 months. I got to stop telling this joke. I'm sick of it. Mm-hmm. The only thing that's weird for me is there are times I question why anything is funny.
See, that was funny. I don't know why, but I just found that hilarious.
Well, if you think about it, comedy is similar to magic in that it's just surprise. You know, mm-hmm. a magician does something here and then the ball is in this hand and you thought it was over here. It's purely about misdirection. Mm-hmm. And so it's weird because when comics watch other comics, we don't laugh that much because we see where the misdirection is. The same way, it's probably very hard for a magician to surprise another magician because they understand the art form. So there are times we'll be laughing, we'll be at a comedy show, and we'll be laughing at the setup before the comedian gets to the punchline because we see where they're going.
Mm-hmm. So how long have you been in comedy?
I think 17 years. And 17 and full-time for 11.
Okay. What got you interested in comedy?
Well, I always thought of funny stuff and would write it down and then maybe would tell it to a friend, but I never had any interest in performing. I was in the fifth grade play and I had three lines and got shot. And I don't even remember what the play was, but for weeks after that, everybody who came up to me would say, hey, I thought you were dead. And I'm like, I'm so sick of hearing this. I'm never getting on stage again. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I'd started selling jokes freelance to Jay Leno for his Tonight Show monologue. Mm-hmm. And I was on a date with somebody who said, hey, why don't you try stand-up comedy? And I said, I'm not really a performer. I like writing, but I don't know about getting on stage in front of people. And she said, She had just had a bout of unemployment. She said she always wanted to try stand-up comedy. And when she wasn't working between jobs, she took a comedy class and said, hey, the graduates of my class have a show. Why don't you come see it? And I thought the show was really good. And I said, hey, why don't I take the class? Mm-hmm. And I did. And 6 years later, I said, I don't want to work in banking anymore, which is what I'd been doing before that.
So everybody has different careers. And it's just interesting because I'm listening to you speak and just in hearing your story, I'm laughing. I find it hilarious. And it reminds me of something a friend of mine said to me one time. She says, Sharifa, you have the most interesting life. And I said, my life is no more interesting than anyone else's. It's just the way I tell it. You know, so just you, all you had to say was you were a kid, you were on a stage, you had three lines and you died. But it's just like you're picturing in your mind because we can see this, we can experience. So we enjoy it. So I love that. Sean, I will be right back with you, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest because Sean went from being a banker or in banking to comedy. And Adam, you work with people on building wealth. So I want to go ahead and introduce Mr. Adam Duran, Prevail Innovative Wealth Strategies, and he helps people make good money and create a tax-free retirement. Good morning, Adam. How are you?
Hi there. I'm doing great. Thank you for the opportunity to be on today. And this has been a great conversation so far. I love the diverse mix we have here.
Absolutely. Have you ever considered comedy?
I haven't. I don't think telling jokes is one of my natural gifts. So no, I haven't.
But that's okay. What are your natural gifts? Let's talk about some of those. Is it making money? Is it the gift of manifestation? What is it?
Well, I could really relate to what Nadine was saying when she was saying, you know, when you're ahead of your time or before your time, you question yourself, you doubt yourself, people treat you like you're crazy. I've had a lot of those experiences. So I would say I've been an entrepreneur of heart because I know what it's like to see maybe one of the next things coming and how we maybe as a culture, as a group, aren't doing things the way we ought to, and we ought to adjust, you know, just based on where the future's headed. And then trying to lean into that and having people think I'm crazy for it.
That sounds like a story. Somewhere I heard a story. So I'm like, well, what happened? Adam's told something. He said, we're going to make electricity. And the people said, electricity? You're crazy. Like, I need to hear this story.
So I think a lot of it plays into why I got into financial services. Because the career I had before this, I was a police officer for 15 years.
Oh, wow. And
I loved that initially. For the first 10 years, I just really enjoyed it because I knew from the time I was a kid, that's what I wanted to do. I grew up watching cops on TV with my grandpa at night, and it just looked like an exciting job. And it was really exciting. And I liked the service aspect to it also. I could go home feeling like I had done something with purpose for the day. But as I got into that career, after those first 10 years had passed, I was then married, had a kid, and just my priorities in life shifted. It wasn't all about having an exciting experience at work anymore. It was about making it home from work. my priorities shifted. The other thing I noticed was after committing 10 years to that career financially, my family was still as broke as we'd ever been. And I was tired of living broke and check to check all the time. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wasn't the only one in that position. There's a lot of people in America that can relate to that. And so I just started on a personal level studying wealth and wealth building and started kind of figuring out, you know, what has worked for people over the course of history. And there hasn't been a whole lot of change in that. But the way we do things, at least in America, as far as our traditional financial planning system is broken, it doesn't align with what actually works to build wealth. And traditional financial planning takes control from the client, takes control from the individual, and puts it in the hands of a total stranger. Mm-hmm. And that total stranger is then paid off a portion of your wealth year after year, whether they make you money or they don't. Mm-hmm. And we just hope that 30 years from when we started, it'll all work out all right.
Right.
And it doesn't put the client in a position of control. So through my own evolution and learning process of, you know, how to build wealth and what actually works, and my desire to get out of the career I was doing that was, you know, it wasn't any longer about the excitement. It was about how can I be more there for my family? I started looking into, well, how can I get into the wealth advising space and be a disruptor and, you know, carry the message of, hey, here's what I've learned that actually works.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I want to hear the message. Here's what I've learned that actually worked. But before we get to that, What was your transition like? Are you one of those people who, you know, because I'm telling you how I am. I'm one of those people that hardly ever give a lot of thought to my next move sometimes. I get frustrated, like, I'm done with this. So were you like that with being a police officer? I can't do it. I can't go back in. Or did you say, you know what, let me set up my 5-year plan to figure out the evolution to the next stage I want to go or somewhere in between?
It was more the 5-year plan model. And honestly, I didn't know where I'd end up. I knew that, and I can really associate with Nadine's story. I knew that I was really tired of such a rigid structure where I just felt like somebody was always telling me where I needed to be when and what I needed to do. And I didn't like that. I didn't like reporting to people that I thought I was smarter than.
We got a lot of intelligent people here today.
And so I just began, you know, the wheels started turning. Okay, what am I going to do next? And I initially thought that I was going to be in real estate full time. And by the way, I love real estate. It's one of my favorite asset classes. It's a fantastic way to build wealth. I encourage all the clients I work with to at least explore real estate as one of their asset classes to get involved in. So I did a lot of, I set up an LLC and started getting into several different modes of real estate investing between wholesaling and rentals and things like that. And that went well, but I realized that I liked to own real estate and I liked the income it produced. I did not like to sell it. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to be full-time in real estate because I don't like selling it. I like buying it. So what am I going to do to make the money to buy more of it? I had a little bit of a foray in multi-level marketing, network marketing. Also love that business model, and it was a lot of fun. It introduced me to international travel. I traveled all over with the company I was with. But again, I just didn't feel like I was in my sweet spot because the essence of that business is recruiting a team and inspiring that team on a daily basis.
Yes.
And that just isn't, that's not my sweet spot. I wanted to work one-to-one with people to help them manage their financial future, basically. And so it was my wife who said, you know, you've made this big thing about for yourself, learning how to build wealth and learning how to do finances. Why don't you help people individually with theirs? And what I told her was, and Nadine, maybe you'll understand this because that's where the doubt came in. I said, I don't want to function like the rest of the industry functions. I don't know how I'll ever make it because I won't fit. And she said, that's exactly why you need to do it.
That is so beautiful. Yeah. Congratulations to your wife. It's wonderful when that's what we're talking, like you said, when we're talking to Nadine about having those people around us that actually support us. And I understand that because I've been divorced twice. And I think in the root of both of them is my spirit of being an entrepreneur, where they were both and still are very corporate, you know, been at their jobs for 26 years, you know, so they didn't understand that spirit. So I think it's beautiful that your wife was so supportive. Nadine, I just wanted you to give you opportunity to kind of to respond to Adam if you had any thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam, that was such an amazing story in regards to the multi-level marketing. I know that. I've been there. That's where I started, multi-level marketing. I've been in and out of different multi-level marketing and direct sales companies. And a lot of them just didn't feel right because you want to do what you want to do. You want to do it in the way that you want to do it. And in that multi-level marketing and direct sales industry, it's all about being coachable and replicating and duplicating the success, right? And yep. It feels really, you know, difficult to really be who you are. So again, like what Sharifa was saying, the fact that you have a wife that's super supportive, that's amazing. And the fact that she said that to you, that really resonated, where she's like, the fact that nobody else is doing it is all the more reason why you should do it. And I totally commend that. I respect that because that's kind of like where I'm at, because especially when you have a lot of things that you're interested in, a lot of different skills, gifts and abilities and talents, and you're like, how do I merge this all together? And a lot of people don't understand that. So I love that.
Yeah. I want to go back over to you, Sean, real quick. One of the, we always talk about industries that have been affected, especially during COVID and this global pandemic. And I know stand-up comedy was just literally wiped away. Yeah. And comedians have been trying to figure out ways. And some of the conversations I've seen is like stand-up comedians, it's a certain environment that you're used to being in, a certain type of crowd. They're out, they're drinking, they're having fun. And it hasn't been the same to do a show via Zoom. What have you seen? What are some of the conversations that you've had?
Well, we're slowly figuring out the technology to make comedy work on Zoom mm-hmm. in terms of feeling like there's an audience. Because okay. if you have, like, I did a Zoom show last week, and I think there were 42 people in the audience, which is actually pretty big for a Zoom show. And you right. get the array on your screen of, you know, we do gallery view, so we can actually see people's faces. Mm-hmm. And it's still, it's not the same. And the problem is, really, it's hard to charge people for a comedy show on Zoom. We can pass a tip jar, but if we say to somebody, you know, why don't you pay $5 to watch some comedians on Zoom? They'll be like, for a little more than that, we can have a whole month of comedy on Netflix
right.
or Amazon.
Right.
So the economics don't really work. The only thing we can try to do is make them feel like they're part of the show. and make them feel like they're really in an audience at a comedy show instead of watching it on TV. And the way to do that is to engage them directly and to say, ask Sharifa, is your first name Ask or whatever, just to, you know, just to, I mean, that's not particularly funny, but just to.
I found it funny.
All right. Well, okay. I guess it's not up to me to decide what's funny. It's up to the audience. But it's in comedy, it's called crowd work, where you actually directly engage with the audience and ask questions and make them feel like they're part of the show. And that's the only real way to do it on Zoom. But yeah, we've got to wait until COVID is over in order to open venues. There are some clubs that are opening. And if you think about it, you have a lot of people in a small room drinking, a guy on stage talking loudly and basically breathing at the audience. And I say, I don't want to, and that's a terrible environment for COVID. And I say, I don't want to become the funniest person in America because everybody else died. I just think we should just wait. We really should wait. I unfortunately, it's basically we lost a year.
Yes. So do you do your stand-up comedy sitting down?
No, actually. there's reason I think most comics stand up is not only because you're higher up on stage when you're standing up, but also you have a lot more energy standing up. I'm sitting down now and I'm trying very hard not to just sound like this. Because when you're sitting down, you lose a lot of the energy that you need to be on stage. So that's the reason a lot of comics stand up.
So on the Zoom, they have to be standing up. Interesting, interesting. Laura, we've been having a very interesting conversation. Did you have any thoughts for any of the other guests?
Well, I wanted to share one of the funniest jokes that I've heard recently, which is just a one-liner, which is how to fold soup. I find that pretty funny.
How do you fold soup?
Yeah.
That's what I want to know. Like, how do you fold soup? Like,
well, I don't think you can.
You just kind of... I don't know. Where'd you hear that joke, Laura?
From a friend.
That's not like a whole secret over there.
But when you cook, though, sometimes they say fold a liquid into another liquid and there's no folding. So I guess technically you can fold soup.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, when you have soup in a sandwich, do you fold the soup in half to make a sandwich?
I think... humor is super important in life and is super important in learning. I think that there's this whole theory of flow that when we're in a kind of mode or our learning mode, we're like charged. And I think a way to get there is often by laughing. And I don't think we all do enough of that, especially during a pandemic.
Well, studies have shown that people remember better if there's comedy, if there's humor in the content. And that's, and also they're happier about it. I don't know if people here know Chris Voss. He's an former FBI hostage negotiator who teaches about negotiation. And
his book right now.
Yeah. It's a great book. It's the opposite of every other book on negotiation.
Okay.
Well, he'll say things like, you know, they teach you negotiation, get the person saying yes. People don't want to say yes. They want to say no because they want to feel like they have some control. Anyway, he says, if you want to be a public speaker, you don't have to be funny unless you want to get paid. And that's really, it makes a difference. And you don't need a lot. It's like, think about it this way. You can go see a serious dramatic movie, but at least there's two or three things to laugh at in every single movie. If you see a movie and there's zero laughter for 90 minutes, that's a really tough time.
Is that what we learned about on Brain Champagne?
Brainchampagne.com is my website. Thanks for the plug. I will say this. There's 50,000 words. There's so much comedy on my website. There's 50,000 words worth of comedy on my website. And to give you an idea how much content that is, a novel is about maybe 100,000 words. So that's a lot of jokes.
Yeah. So we could just go there and check out all of your jokes and just make our day better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I want to share this because I send out a monthly email that's original comedy and comedy content. And this is a response I got from somebody who came to a show years ago. She wrote, I do so enjoy hearing from you anyway, but with COVID-19 still hanging tough, you and your special talent and take on various things, you are absolutely the best medicine as we continue to hang on during these crazy times. Thanks so much for sharing your best stuff. And I don't want to. And I don't want to tell her that's not even my best stuff. My best stuff is when I'm on stage.
You don't want to break her heart, Sean. See, we have to laugh, make this world a better place, but we have to also make sure that when we decide to retire, that we retire and have some money to be able to enjoy life. So, Adam, talk to us about some of the strategies, tips, resources that you recommend for our viewers.
Yeah. Well, I think if there's one thing that you could take away that could be life-changing, I will share what I see probably being the biggest concern when I have folks come into my office and we meet with them for the first time and we start getting into their financial details. And this is going to apply to most Americans, is that the way we are set up by default with our employers, you know, employers' retirement plans that they give us, or if you went out and opened your own retirement plan, most often those are what's called pre-tax plans. And so we've accumulated, most of us have accumulated the majority of our personal net worth in a pre-tax account. These are things like a 401k, a traditional IRA, 403b, 457, all that number and letter soup of retirement plans. And when we look at tax rates historically, well, I always ask people, you know, where do you feel like tax rates are? And of course they say, oh, high as they've ever been. Where do you think tax rates are headed in the future? Oh, definitely up. And I would agree with that second sentiment. But if you understand the history of tax rates in the US, and I love to throw this out as a trivia question, the highest tax rate ever that we've had in the history of the US was 94%.
Oh, wow.
94%. And that was in 1944 and 1945. Mm-hmm. And that helped us fund World War II.
Okay.
Where we're at today, the top tax bracket in the US is 37%.
Oh, wow.
So when you look at it with a historical perspective, and then you look at especially what's gone on with the pandemic and with the government spending here, you know, I just feel like there's no way tax rates can go anywhere but up. So if that's the reality, and if you agree with that, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, then why in the world are we accumulating the majority of our wealth in accounts that we are growing larger and larger, and then one day we're going to end up having to pay the taxes when we take that money out?
Right.
If we think tax rates are going up, wouldn't it be that we would want to get the tax out of the way today while tax rates are on sale, and then accumulate our wealth and our net worth and be able to take that money out tax-free in the future? And by the way, there's nothing unethical or immoral about that. The government gives you an option. You can pay now or pay later. It's your choice. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of being educated. And I feel like, so with the majority of folks I meet with, 80% or better of everything they've accumulated is in that tax deferred bucket. So we try to get strategic about how can we help you shift the assets you've already accumulated into a tax-free category. And then going forward, whatever contributions you're making, how can we help you get that into a tax-free category? And the reason that's so important is because if you're planning for 20 years from now, 30 years from now, income that you plan to live off of, how can you actually plan your income if you don't even know what the tax rate's going to be and you haven't paid taxes on the money?
Mm.
And so I just see that as probably the most significant flaw in traditional financial planning. And it's something I spend a lot of time talking with clients about. And we can put you in a lot more control if you can actually plan your income with certainty.
Yes, absolutely. I like that. Nadine, I want to go over to you real quick. Again, you focus on women's empowerment. What are some of the conversations that you've been having with your clients in regards to business empowerment, making the pivot during COVID? What are the most, I guess, conversations you've been having?
I think for me, the biggest part was finding how to transition into doing things online. Mm-hmm. A lot of ladies that I know, one of my friends that I actually had a conversation with her, we did like a live video interview, and she had just left her job as a nurse, and she went into doing like an event planning type of company. Well, not event planning per se, but like an event space. She has like a co-working space. So to invest all of this and to go into that and have this event space that she can't use, how is she going to be able to monetize it when everything's pretty much shut down? So she basically started doing a virtual event. So basically my thing that I've been going back and really helping people understand, especially the people that don't have a business right now that only had the one stream of income from working a job or things like that, is saying, well, now you have all the time to do the things that you really, really want to do. when no one's going to work, everybody's home, how are you going to utilize that time? What are the steps that you're going to take in order to educate yourself on what's out there, what's available, and looking to start building your business or just doing the things that you really enjoy? I think Adam had mentioned earlier about leaning into, like, basically, I like to say leaning into what feels good. Like, he was kind of looking for something that, like, he really enjoyed, because at the end of the day, and even, you know, with what Sean was saying about comedy and how when there was that whole situation with him going out and he couldn't talk about the politics, and that lady was like, well, you're here to get away from it all, right? So I think COVID and being home was a time for people to get away from that programming of society, like, you have to have a job and this is the way it has to be, and recognizing that there is no stability. So just being creative, thinking about how you can move your life forward in a way that's different than what society's told you it has to be, like getting up and going to work and having a job, and, you know, just doing that pivot, like Laura was saying, going online, which was huge for a lot of people. A lot of people were afraid of online, but I was reading the other day that apparently online sales tripled during COVID, right? Because no one could go to a conventional store, everyone's shopping online. So we're in the midst of this pandemic and people are spending more money online than they ever have before. So just recognizing those opportunities and seeing where your gifts and your talents can allow you to attract your audience, to build your tribe, if you can overcome that fear of what could go wrong and think about, well, what could go right if I'm out here having fun and doing things that light me up.
I think that's wonderful. Laura, how did you feel about making that transition online? Was that difficult for you?
It was, because I really believed that you need the in-person connection with each child. So I was a little pessimistic, but I was actually shocked that there's certain things that are actually better. What we found is that some of our kids in our RoboFun classes were a little more focused at home than they are in the studio. And I think, I'm not sure how long this moment is going, but people are really bored. Kids are bored. So they're really pouring it in. But also, when you only have five children at once, and a lot of our classes, frankly, a lot of parents are getting some really great deals, because we'll run them if there's two, three, four, or five. So, you know, there's one teacher, and often in the wings, there's a tech person. So if something goes wrong, we support the families to get back on Zoom or whatever the issue is. But there's a level of focus that's pretty amazing. I think the journey of an entrepreneur is really fun, and it's equally fun to find out when you're absolutely wrong. So I was totally wrong that online could work very, very well. And that's a fun thing. That's a fun way to be wrong. Some of the ways that have been very cool, we have one grandma who called in and said, I want to connect two of my grandsons. One lives in California and one lives on the west, in the East Coast. Can we do a class just with the two of them?
Aww.
And it was so sweet. And then she would kept reporting to us on what she was learning through conversations they were having with her about the class. And she said, you know, you're doing something right, because they keep talking about it and they keep thinking about these concepts. And one of my goals with kids is that the concepts they're learning are not just about programming or circuitry, but that they can apply them to the larger world. And if you can explain to your grandma what you're doing, then I think that's good.
I think that's good as well.
And it's I think the common theme here among all of us is really supportive loved ones into going into any venture is really the most important thing.
What did your family say, or your loved ones, when you went into comedy?
Well, I will tell you this. I came out when I was in college. I sat my mother and father down and I said, Mom, Dad, I'm not going to medical school. So,
Were you disowned?
What?
Were you disowned?
No, but actually they were okay, because I went into finance. But they understood I was doing comedy. They thought it was, you know, a hobby, and I was making a little money. And I sat them down and I had a business plan. I was very businesslike about it. My father is an accountant. And my mother was a teacher, and I sat down and I said, here's how much, you know, I'm making as a banker. Here's what I actually need to live on. Here's how much I'm making now in comedy. And here are all the changes I'm going to make more money. I'm not going to starve. And it was actually, they supported me, but it was hard for them because they lived through the Depression. And to them, financial security was everything.
Yeah. Yes. But sometimes it's, even though with the financial security, it's like they want you to have certain types of job, like parents, like being a doctor, being a lawyer. It's like, it's not always just about the income, because comedians, successful comedians, these guys make the Kevin Harts of the world, you know, but it's like parents, like, go get a real job, get a real job. It doesn't matter.
Well, you know, the difference is, I guess, you know, Kevin, there's a few comedians, there's a few entertainers who make gobs of money. Yes. There's a few athletes who make gobs of money. The difference is you can tell right away if you have any chance of being a pro ball player, whereas you don't have that in entertainment. I mean, at this point, I'm not going to make Kevin Hart money, but I make a living.
Dang, that's the most important thing. Who knows what the future holds? Now, we are coming down to the last few minutes of the show. And what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience, to everyone who is watching this show live, as well as everyone who is watching it in the archives, and simply let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance here today. And we're going to start with you, Laura.
All right, I'm Laura Hart. I've been in business for 22 years. I love helping children love to learn. If you're home anywhere in the world, we're running these online classes, robofund.org. If you happen to be in New York, 14 lucky kids get to use our RoboFund Center, which usually has a whole lot more kids, for our enrichment center. So if you have school 2 days a week and you're pulling out your hair at home and want to send them somewhere, we'll help them with their schoolwork and teach them fun STEM things. So RoboFund.org, we love helping children love to learn.
Mm-hmm. They have to love to learn. Yes. Sean, what do you have for us?
Well, I was at a networking event about a decade ago, and the speaker at the networking event said to tell the whole group what we do. And I said, you know, my job speaks for itself. I'm a stand-up comedian, which I did not intend to be a punchline or a pun, but they laughed like crazy, and I was kind of surprised. And then he said, since this was a networking event at the Princeton Club, he wanted to be snooty. He's like, oh, we need to know the function of your job in society, and can you elaborate? And like, I have the easiest job in the world to explain. Like, you're a comedian, or you're a dentist, or you're a cop. You don't need to. That's all you need to say. If you're a police officer, or a dentist, or a comedian, or a hockey player, that's all you have to say. It's not intricate. But he wanted a more detailed explanation of why my job existed. And I said, it's my job to make you forget how much you hate your job. And they seem to like that. So that's what I'm sticking with.
That's your story. You're sticking with it. I love that. That's great. Adam, what do you have for us?
I would say if there's one thing I want folks to take away, it's that traditional financial services does not put you in a position of control. And so the burden of my heart is that everybody would be actively engaged with their finances and be in control. So the big takeaway is tax rates are likely to go up in the future. And you're in a position of control if you're insulated from rising tax rates. That's something that I can help with. And I think you included my website on the show intro, but really the easiest way for folks to reach me is directly through LinkedIn. I'm the only Adam Doran that I've seen on there. And I think, you know, by my picture, you can recognize me. So I'm on LinkedIn every day and love to connect with people through there.
I'll definitely connect with you. Thank you, Adam. Nadine.
I really just want the audience to know that you can do anything that you put your mind to. Every single one of us sitting on this call right now didn't know that we would be doing what we're doing at this point in our lives. Our lives looked way different. And if we didn't bet on ourselves, if we didn't take the time and the effort to really think about what feels good to us and try to create a life around that, we wouldn't be sitting here on this show. So I just really want to encourage you guys to try new things. I was nervous at the beginning of the show. I was second guessing myself, even as a woman empowerment mentor, but you know, you got to do the uncomfortable things and try new things. And when you do that, you have amazing experiences. Being on the show has been amazing. Connecting with all of you here has been amazing. And I love hanging out on Instagram. That's my place where I like to be. It's at Entice the Brand. So if you guys ever want to come by and see what I got going on, the different ways that I empower women, definitely feel free to reach out. And yeah, have a great day and keep loving yourselves.
I think that's wonderful, wonderful words. Yes, I think everyone's nervous to be on the show because everybody wants to know, Sharifa, what are you going to ask? I'm like, I don't know. Whatever the spirit moves me at the time, it's like I see squirrels and wherever I go. But it's always interesting and we always have the opportunity to learn from each other. And I've learned so much about comedy, STEM, empowerment, retirement. Every guest, you learn something. And then I bring that information on to other shows because I can share your stories. And like I say about all of my shows, the reason why these shows are so important to me personally is because people come to me and they say, Sharifa, I can't do this because I can't do this because I'm a woman. I can't do this because I'm broke. I can't do, and I'm like, let me watch an episode, tune in, because people can do it. They are doing it and you can do it too. So you are motivating a lot of people. So I appreciate all of you. And I want to thank you for being a guest on today's episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. And I especially want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch the show live, as well as everyone who is watching it in the archives. Just because you didn't catch the live show does not mean you're not important, that we don't still need your support. Please go ahead and share the show. Also, don't just watch the show. Don't just share the show. Please support our guests. Visit their websites. Their websites, their bios are in the Facebook post. Check them out. Follow them on social media. Send them a message. And when you send them that message, please let them know Sharifa Hardy says hi. And if you're interested in more ways that I can help you and your business, or if you're interested in being a guest, please visit the website at AskSharifa.com. Until tomorrow at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.
See you. Thanks.